Good morning, universe, and welcome to another day redeemed from death and looking forward to life because of what our Lord Jesus Christ has done for us. You're listening to Sharper Iron, waking you up every morning with the law and gospel of the living God, drawn straight from the text of Holy Scripture for you, all a part of your morning drive for the soul, here on Worldwide KFUO, Christ for you, anytime, anywhere. I'm your host, Pastor Jonathan Fisk, administrative pastor at St. Paul Lutheran Church in Rockford, Illinois, and on this Friday, it's Friday, on this Friday, the 10th of May, the day before I turn a glorious 41 years old, we are going to be looking at Genesis chapter 24. I don't know what I was thinking. I picked a lot of verses for this day. Chapter 24, verses 15 through 51, a great deal of ground to cover as the servant of Abraham finishes his prayer about how to pick a girl for Isaac, the chosen firstborn, well, trueborn of Abraham, and what the fallout of that is, who this girl is, and there's too much for me to even summarize right now. We just need to get into it. To help us get into it this morning, we have with us Pastor Adam Kuntz. He is pastor at, oh goodness, Adam, I have forgotten the name of your congregation.
Mount Calvary. Yeah.
I'm thankful that God was here to help us. I don't know if you guys all know this, but when I forget something, the voice of God just drops out of the sky and says Mount Calvary. Maybe you didn't hear that. Adam Kuntz, my producer, jumped in and said Mount Calvary. And Mount Calvary Lutheran Church in Lititz, Pennsylvania. The reason why I can't believe I forget that is because, of course, I served out in that area with you, and Mount Calvary was in my circuit. So with that said, I want to dig straight at the text this morning, fast as we can, because there's lots of ground to cover. Opening question is the first one you threw me in your notes, and it does come out of yesterday's conversation. When you go to pick a wife, how do you do it? And is this prescriptive for doing this? We never really got to this yesterday. Or is this just a descriptive situation here as he asks for a sign?
Yeah, I think when you're reading narrative in the Bible, when the Bible is telling you some kind of story, it's helpful to figure out how many times does a detail appear. The details are never incidental, but how often do they appear? The detail about the good looks of some of the matriarchs in Genesis recurs frequently, and it's no different today. Rebecca is very beautiful in appearance, but the question is not only about her physical appearance, but also about how she relates to the promises which have been passed down from Adam to Abraham at this point. And they want to pass that promise on into another generation. So there's a twofold issue of, yeah, she's beautiful, that's great, but also how does she relate to, how does she know, how will she participate in the passing down of the promises concerning the seed of the woman to a new generation.
We also talked yesterday about her hospitality and how the prayer of the servant is one that is maybe not purely just seeking for, you know, give me the one, show me the magical person who will do what I say, mm-hmm. but is let me find one who is hospitable. Mm-hmm. And then that's what she does. She goes the extra mile in order to receive him. And now this connects to her spirit, which will connect to her faith. Would you agree with that as well?
Yeah. Her serving is an expression of her way in the world, in the way that the Old Testament especially loves to talk about someone's way. And the Lord has certain ways, and different people or even animals in the book of Job have a way. Rebecca's way is a way of serving and kindness, of provision. And the servant is, I think, not just looking, you know, yeah, for a specific sign, but he's looking generally for a woman who has this way about her. There's other stuff that's going to be necessary, but that way of serving, of kindness, of gentleness, is a prerequisite in his mind.
So would you go so far as to say that this is not like Gideon? Like, this is not, hey, I want a specific sign?
Well, no, it's not, because for Gideon, that sign is enough, right? It's about the wetness or the dryness of the fleece in the morning, right? All you need is that sign. Here, there are several other factors, and I think that is one of the insights for us about marriage, is that a lot of times people go on one or two factors in deciding whom to marry. Usually it's looks, might be personality, might be something else. They might not be able to put it into words, but I think people should notice that there are actually several factors, because there's a sequence of events and discussions in this chapter. Each of them is necessary, each of these steps in the sequence, but one of them is not isolated. It's not like he says, okay, I got the sign, let's go, you know, get on my camel. Time's a wasting here. So there are several steps. One of them is the step of recognizing a woman as hospitable, serving, gentle.
I tried that line with my wife when I first met her. I said, I got the sign, get on the camel, let's go. It didn't go. She's like, I got to know you first. Let's talk a little.
Right. Yeah. There's a few more things there.
Oh, man. Okay. I'm not sure how to handle the text in that I gave you way too much to possibly, we got to read it. So I'm going to just start reading some of this, and then we'll come back and talk about this. Marriage is a great place to go from this. So Genesis chapter 24, verse 15, the servant of Abraham is here having prayed along the way that he would find the right wife for Isaac, that this has to do with the hospitality at the well, the ladies who are mostly probably related to Abraham by extension through his brother, all come out, they're drawing the water. He asks before, well, here it comes. But before he had finished speaking, behold, Rebekah, who was born to Bethuel, the son of Milcah. So Milcah is the niece of Abraham, who marries Abraham's brother, Nahor. She is the wife of Nahor. Abraham's brother came out with her water jar on her shoulder. The young woman was very attractive in appearance, a maiden whom no man had known. She went down to the spring and filled her jar and came up. Then the servant ran to meet her and said, "Please give me a little water to drink from your jar." She said, "Drink, my lord." And she quickly let down her jar upon her hand and gave him the drink. When she had finished giving him a drink, she said, "I will draw water for your camels also until they have finished drinking." So she quickly emptied her jar into the trough and ran again to the well to draw water. And she drew for all his camels. The man gazed at her in silence to learn whether the Lord had prospered his journey or not. A couple thoughts just in this. I mean, clearly it's fulfilling the prayer again, which I get scared because it leads us to mysticism. Why do we, to total left turn though, it's like the text is at pains to not tell us this guy's name. I mean, he has to be talked about a lot here. Do you have any thoughts on that? Why he is unnamed at this point?
Yeah, and sometimes people assume his name is Eliezer of Damascus because that's mm-hmm. the heir whom Abram names when he believes that he will never actually have a son. But yeah, the text itself does not give us the man's name. I think his anonymity is because of his status. His name is kind of irrelevant because his father is irrelevant. In this time and place, there aren't really last names, obviously. And you can see that people are named according to their ancestry. And this man's ancestry is irrelevant to the issue. So the text is always sparing in details, but I think the reason that it's not here is because his ancestry is null and void. Now, people will notice that that is unusual, and they're right to notice that, because generally when the Bible discusses anyone at all, ancestry is provided because the Bible looks at ancestry as actually important and sometimes determinative for someone's character in a way that modern people don't really. I mean, it's almost modern people often, like, you don't know who their mom or dad are or what their names are or what they did with their lives, let alone their grandparents, right. until you know them right. for a while. But the Bible usually takes notice of ancestry. Where it doesn't, it's highly unusual. And it's because this man's ancestry, the passing on of his legacy is not the issue. So his ancestry is not noticed.
Okay. Yeah, that makes sense. So he's not nameless, but in terms of history and society, he kind of is. It still seems just like they're going out of the way.
Especially in a chapter about marriage and the passing on of promises, notion of somebody who seems to have come from nowhere and will leave nothing behind him is especially poignant.
Yeah. Wow. You made me think of Melchizedek with that, which he is not, right? But right. coming from nowhere, going to leaving nothing. Okay. I want to make a joke about Jonathan, son of Dale, too, but we'll leave it at that. So when the camels had finished drinking, the man took a gold ring weighing a half shekel and two bracelets for her arm weighing 10 gold shekels, pretty heavy, actually, and said, "Please tell me whose daughter you are. Is there room in your father's house for us to spend the night?" This is important because this is about ancestry, is what he's asking. He doesn't know for sure that she's of the lineage. He doesn't know her name's Rebecca or any of that. She said to him, "I am the daughter of Bethuel, the son of Milcah, whom she bore to Nahor." She added, "We have plenty of both straw and fodder and room to spend the night." The man bowed his head and worshipped the Lord and said, "Blessed be the Lord, the God of my master Abraham, who has not forsaken his steadfast love and his faithfulness toward my master." There is an amazing connection to his faith in the promises given to Abraham. I mean, this guy's a Christian. "As for me, the Lord has led me in the way to the house of my master's kinsman." Then the young woman ran and told her mother's household about these things. So again, her hospitality comes up here, right? Her willingness to receive, which is not only, I mean, it is an Eastern culture thing, but it is something to be desirable in humans. And then on top of that, it's something to be desirable in the faithfulness of woman, right? And her role as caregiver and caretaker. Anything else in there that connects?
Yeah, I just want people to notice the several different signs or markers that he takes cognizance of. In the first section that you read, she's very attractive. It also says, "a maiden whom no man had known," and that is said in connection with her appearance. People may or may not know that in most societies, there is a strict difference in physical dress for women who are married and women who are unmarried, unmarried being a presumption of virginity, which is why the word for woman of marriageable age and virgin are the same in most of the Old Testament. So he can see from how she dresses that she is unmarried. He can also see that she's beautiful. In 21, he is gazing at her in silence because it's still up in the air. She has done what he asked for, but there's still more to ask about. So now he's going to ask about her lineage. And that is what is confirmed in the section that you just read, like in verse 24. And then he needs to talk to her family. She refers to her mother's household, so it's possible, especially because she's going to bring out her brother in a second. It seems that her father is dead, but the family is making decisions collectively. That's the presumption, that the household will make decisions collectively. And I think, actually, a lot of things in this passage are not, I wouldn't exoticize them too much because they are, I think, much more normal for human history than a lot of us have experience of. That is, women dressing distinctively based on their marital status. Even the notion of hospitality, I mean, I find this is simply more common in rural places where you see people less often and where, you know, you don't have a restaurant to go out to. Hospitality is bigger when people are, you know, less frequently with one another. So the family is going to deliberate on this. That is maybe one of the weirdest things about the concept of marriage in the Old Testament for modern people, is that marriage is a group collective reality, not an individual decision.
Right. You don't marry an individual, you marry a family.
Marry a family. Yeah, and we kind of say that like as a psychological insight because it's true. You marry somebody's genetic history. You marry that person's family dynamics. You marry that person's dysfunctional relationship with her father. You marry the whole thing. I think that one of the things about modern people is that we simply act as if none of that is real. We don't take it into account because we have kind of a myth of individual.
Pastor Kuntz, love conquers all. Come on,
yeah,
now.
I guess it does.
We believe that love conquers all, but by love we do not mean complete fidelity or self-sacrificial giving. We mean attraction to them, which you said good looks earlier. I think it's sexual attraction, right? And by that passionate sexual attraction that has convinced us that we are right from each other, all the rest of this can be ignored. And we don't just believe this. We teach it dogmatically. Yeah. And it's quite dangerous. So the idea that we should talk about these quaint, weird old customs of a world where there was no divorce, there was no abortion, you know? And it wasn't just a matter of you're not allowed to, like they really believe that you shouldn't. Maybe there's something to learn here about how to pick a spouse, right?
Yeah.
And I think this idea of collective thinking, it's not as though dad just says this is it, but that dad and mom and maybe even brothers and sisters have insight you don't. And can be a part of this conversation. That's huge. That's huge.
Yeah, it is. It also sees your life as pertinent to your family and the family's collective well-being. That you don't just represent yourself. You are always part of your family. And I find that these things are true whether or not people want them to be. So what I find is that often people will ignore some of the factors that we just talked about, like where somebody comes from, what their family is like. They'll ignore those things until they impinge upon their lives. Let's say you bring a lot of dysfunction from your family into your marriage, and then you didn't really talk about that, and it's not like the two families even necessarily met each other before the wedding day. And then, 3 years in, you start to have big problems, and you realize maybe your spouse doesn't even realize, that you are bringing your family's dysfunction into the marriage. The families didn't know each other. You didn't know that you were going to do this, but it just kind of happened. I think that ancient people were, in this way, wiser about how people relate to what we refer to blithely as background than we are. I think they understood that background is not in the back. It's who you are.
I kind of want to chase that, but it's also a nice segue into the next section because, honestly, Laban isn't exactly the guy I'd want to marry into his family, and he gets mentioned next. I wonder if this will come back. Let's see. Verse 29 says, Rebecca had a brother whose name was Laban. Laban ran out toward the man to the spring. By the way, and you mentioned that it's interesting that it's not Nahor, and that the implication here is that Nahor has died, and so Laban now is the man of the house, which that sounds so quaint and or sexist today too. But, in a world of traveling bandits without doors on your tent, I'd want the strongest male to go out first myself. It's just kind of how it would be, right? It just makes sense. So Laban ran out toward the man to the spring. Listen to me apologize for it, though. Isn't that interesting how you and I talked yesterday in another place about appeasement, and I just did it. Laban ran out toward the man to the spring. As soon as he saw the ring and the bracelets on his sister's arm and heard the words of Rebecca, his sister. So she's already got the gifts on her arm, though. This is like reciprocation is part of this, too. Like you can't just get a gift. It doesn't quite work like that. So that's interesting. He heard the words of Rebecca's sister. Thus the man spoke to me. He went out to the man. Behold, he was standing by the camels at the spring. Verse 31. He said, come in, O blessed of the Lord. Huh. Interesting. Why do you stand outside? For I prepared the house and a place for the camels. So the man came to the house and unharnessed the camels and gave straw and fodder to the camels, and there was water to wash his feet and the feet of the men who were with him. So hospitality again. Then food was set before him to eat. But he said, I will not eat until I have said what I have to say. He said, this is Laban says, speak on. Now again, what an interesting series of events here. I want to let you just take at it. What do you see? What do you see?
Yeah, Laban is welcoming the visitor because he is in charge of the household, the father being either absent for some reason or more likely, it seems, dead because they don't mention even waiting to or needing to consult him. So when Laban welcomes this man, Laban has a confession using the personal name of God, so he knows God's name. There is going to be, as we'll find out later on in Genesis, what we call syncretism, the mixing of two religions together. Laban may not be exclusively a worshiper of the true God, but he is at least including the true God in his worship, unless maybe he changes to polytheism later, but That's all a little speculative, but here he is naming the true God, and he recognizes the man as coming from the true God somehow, representing him, blessed by him in some measure. And you're right to point out that Rebecca is already wearing the gift. This is something we should be clear about. The exchange of rings is a modern custom, especially men wearing jewelry is a modern custom. And diamonds come from the De Beers company cornering the market on diamonds in South Africa during the middle years of the British Empire. So what he has given her is pretty unusual, but you will know if you have been following along in Genesis that Abraham is an unusually wealthy man. So this sign of generosity toward her has already been seen by her family. So Laban is obviously intrigued and wants the man to come in, wants to entertain him, wants to help him. So in 33, they set out food, and you would think that after the long journey, he would just want to eat. But most of the rest of the chapter is this man interrupting his own meal to speak. So there's an urgency for him about all of this. And I think the sense of going far away to find your spouse is part of that urgency, because Abraham had already in this chapter specifically forbidden his servant from finding any wife from the land where Abraham actually is. And it's interesting that Abraham believes in the promise concerning the land of Canaan, but he refers to the place to which he's sending the servant, the place where they now are, where Laban is and Rebecca and all the rest, as my country and my kindred, Abraham calls it. So this sense of recognition or fellowship that the servant now has in that land and with that kindred is very strong, but it's also pressing, because I think there's this sense that, like, if I don't get a girl for him here, I don't know where I'm going to get a girl for him.
It's interesting. So he's still wrestling with what we've seen Abraham wrestle with, which is, I know the promises, and I believe them, but I doubt them too. Right. When physical things come into conflict with the possibility of the promise being fulfilled, I think I got to find a way around it. The promise isn't going to do it on its own. And he's being taught, just as Abraham, I think, has been, to mature in that faith and to trust through that God's got this covered. Yeah.
Yeah. I think also on an application level, that we do not have as individual Christians specific promises concerning whether or not we will get married. And that is a discussion for its own time. But I think one takeaway from today is that trust that what God is doing is best is, I think, very difficult in these circumstances. And you can see it in the nervousness and the urgency with which the servant handles the situation, which is all understandable. Something that we haven't really discussed that may be just weird on its face to the listener is the idea that the servant is doing all of this. That Isaac doesn't actually go.
Right. Yeah.
so the servant is being trusted to find a spouse for Isaac for the rest of Isaac's life. And that is something that, I think a lot of times people are entrusting romance or, maybe worse, to algorithms on apps. They're entrusting a person with sussing out who is the right woman for Isaac. And he is taking that extremely seriously. I think the role of matchmaking here is not just setting up two people to go on a date. It is that this man can actually find the right woman, the rightness being, not only looks and marital status, obviously, but also her knowledge of the Lord's promises and coming from the right family. Those are huge. And the final condition here is going to be the discussion with the family. That's going to be finally determinative. If the family will not let her go, she will not go.
Pastor Zimmerman yesterday mentioned that some of the hesitancy to send Isaac to this place may have been Abraham's finally getting the promises about the land. And so, no, chosen Isaac, you don't leave this land. You stay here. I like that idea, but also the history of matchmaking, as you said, or arranging marriages, that's something that the ancient world had as well. What is fascinating, different than what we have today, is that romance was not a part of it at all. I want to pick it up right there on the other side of this break. Sharp Ryan, stick around.
Worldwide KFUO Radio salutes our day sponsors on this Friday, May 10th, 2019. Today's day sponsors are Anthony and Vicki Petzold. Today's day sponsors have made a contribution to KFUO Radio in honor of their wedding anniversary and in thanksgiving to God for the many blessed years of marriage. Once again, we say thank you to Anthony and Vicki Petzold of Kirkwood, Missouri, today's worldwide KFUO day sponsors.
You hear our voices every day as we speak the gospel, share the latest news, or for insightful and sometimes entertaining talk. Why not share your voice with us and send us your feedback, suggestions, and questions? Leave your comment at 314-996-1542. Be sure to follow us on social media, too, so you can like, comment, and share your favorite posts. Drop an email to KFUO at KFUO.org or send a snail mail letter to Worldwide KFUO, 1333 South Kirkwood Road, St. Louis, Missouri, 63122.
This is the day which the Lord has made.
Let us rejoice and be glad.
For the lonely and homebound, for the grieving and dying, and for all those who are afflicted in body, mind, and spirit, especially for me.
Join us for a live broadcast of Chapel at the LCMS International Center weekdays at 10 a.m. on KFUO.
Recently on Law and Gospel, I, Pastor Tom Baker, made a comment that the Garden of Eden was a backtaste of heaven and the Lord's Supper is a foretaste of heaven. That will be one of the questions we'll be answering on the next Open Mic Friday for your phone calls.
Listen to Law and Gospel weekday mornings beginning at 9:30 on KFUO.
So Isaac doesn't go to find his own wife. Instead, his family sends a matchmaker to a foreign land to find the one who is suitable for him in a number of ways. Certain family, stock, certain, looks, wealth, maybe kind of, faith, definitely. All of that has to be done for him. And as we wrestle with this and we talk about how today, the way we would look for a spouse is to believe that romantic passion trumps all other matters. In that ancient world, it would seem they believed the only thing that didn't matter was romantic passion. And were they just wrong? We assume they were, right? You notice that? We assume they were. We don't even question that. It is so foundational to our worldview. And yet, were the biblical patriarchs wrong? Is it descriptive? Is it prescriptive? I've been saying this for a little while now, trying to figure that out with Pastor Adam Kuntz this morning here on Sharp Iron. He is pastor at Mount Calvary Lutheran Church in Lititz, Pennsylvania. Again, we're looking at Genesis chapter 24, verses 15 through 51. Lots of text still ahead of us here, but Pastor Kuntz, I think that the idea of marriage is really worth continuing to walk through as an idea, and the fact that what you were describing earlier as the collective seeking to marry the collective discounts romantic entanglements, just discounts them. I mean, she's pretty sure, but it's just not even on the table as a main idea.
Yeah, it's definitely not a main idea, because I think they were trying to, when you're building for a lifelong marriage, you know that the delight that you have in one another, especially when you're first, as we would say, falling in love, again, not a biblical phrase, but, it describes a real thing, falling in love, or when you are with each other at first. I mean, the Bible recognizes that those things are real, right? You are dispensed from warfare if you are a man. You're dispensed from warfare for a time when you have first gotten married. It's also one of the excuses for in the gospel. I have married a wife. I can't follow Jesus right now because I've married a wife, right? So they understand that you're busy, you're enraptured. Song of Solomon is a beautiful description of marital love. But when you're trying to build for generations, it's simply just insufficient. I mean, building building your marriage on romance or sexual attraction is basically like trying to build a house by just putting up some doors. You know, not a foundation, not any windows, not any framing, just the door. You just set up a couple of doors on a piece of land. You know, it's like, yeah, that's part of a house. That's good. But that's not a house. And that's what a lot of people try to do. They try to build a house just by putting up a couple of doors.
Yeah.
And it's, like, it's just not going to be enough.
It's like deciding what you should eat based entirely on how it tastes. Yeah. All you do is eat what you like. Don't ever eat anything you don't like, and don't take any vitamins. See, that would be doing more. Only eat what tastes good to you. And, well, we know as Americans that's not going so well for us. Whether we'll figure out a way to improve that is another story. But same, I mean, just think about it that way. Look at the marriage that way. If that's all you have is cotton candy, what's the physical body going to look like? And it's not just a matter of getting large. It's a matter of bone structure. It's a matter of cancer. I mean, all this stuff is connected. Diabetes, right? So the same goes for marriage. So that we're not misheard here, Pastor Kuntz. Right? We're not saying that romance is bad or you shouldn't love your spouse in a romantic way. What we're saying is we've overweighted that.
Totally. And when you look back on your life, let's say you make it to 50 years of marriage, the legacy that you're building concerns the people that are around you, right? So the ancients often categorized marriage as having three components, and these are brought up also by the Lutheran fathers because it's in the classical sources: procreation, fidelity, and the idea of, let's say, like binding to one another. When you look back on your life, you're going to look at, okay, kids, grandkids, great-grandkids. You know, when you talk to very elderly people, they don't tell you like, wow, we had this amazing honeymoon and it was so wild and crazy. They tell you how many great-grandkids they had. You know, they tell you what their family is like, where their kids live, that they're going to see their kids in 2 weeks or something. They're going to come to visit, right? They talk about family. They talk about the things that they've been through together, right? So if you want to know about marriage, you should find that out from previous generations, especially those that are still with you, and ask them what got them through. How did they do this? They're not going to talk about, hardly at all, if they do, how they felt about one another when they were both 22. It's fine. It's not bad at all. You know, it's not at all. It's just not really all that helpful in the long run. And they're trying to build here. This is going to be the only monogamous couple among the patriarchs. I mean, they're going to build better than anybody else. Isaac kind of gets short shrift because he's not as, you know, he doesn't have as much airtime as Abraham or Jacob or Joseph. But this is going to be the monogamous patriarch. So I think attention to how his marriage was built is worthwhile.
Oh, that's interesting. That's really interesting. You also talk about then, if you're going to build a legacy, you keep equating building a legacy with building a marriage. That idea in and of itself is one we don't even have on the table, that my life is a legacy. Instead, we usually are thinking about my life as me getting what I want. Or perhaps if there is legacy at all, it is strictly in the realm of career or achievement. Yeah.
Right.
Rarely is that curing cancer. Sometimes it is, but usually it's not even that. It's making money, right? Or being famous, or having some great experience that is one I can love. That's not legacy at all. That's self-inwardness. And the idea that life for all humans, man, woman, everybody, is about building a legacy that is the future of our progeny, the life of our children and their neighbors right? That's just completely lost on us. And that's why to look at marriage as something more than just two individuals who are Twitter-pated is something we can't really comprehend, because we're so hyper-individualized that our entire individual life is not about the future. It's about me today. And I think that's a big piece of this. It's not in the text. That's a big piece of this. So I thought about that, and then I'll read the remainder of the text, and then we'll keep going on whatever we find.
Yeah, when people bring up what they want to do when they grow up, the stuff that people say is just inane. I mean, no one has ever cured cancer. Only 45 people have ever been president in all of American history. The likelihood of ones doing that is infinitesimal. I mean, it's so small as to be absurd. You can actually aspire to be a normal person and raise a good family. That's actually within the realm of possibility for the vast majority of human beings who have ever lived. So that is a much better aspiration. What do you want to be when you grow up? Well, I want to be somebody that is, you know, a good father. That's actually attainable. And that's a good thing. And it leaves a wonderful legacy to the world. Why not aspire to this thing? He's going to reflect the will of God for marriage, like I said, in being monogamous, in a way that his father and his sons will not. That's a wonderful thing. That's an amazing thing. Isaac did not cure cancer. He didn't redeem the world from sin. He was not the Messiah, but he raised his family. That's a great thing, and that's something that I wish, you know, I wish people didn't so much want to cure cancer or be president or be an astronaut as simply be a normal human being and raise a good family. It's a wonderful thing.
The president one, I don't like as much because it just, I don't know. I don't mind having goals. You should have goals. But to recognize, as you've said very, very astutely, have a few goals that are like guaranteed, right? Like ones you can reach. Like if you want to have this really pipe dream, I got a pipe dream. I want to write fiction books that sell. But, you know, it may never happen. So whatever. But what you have in front of you, what is actually there and attainable in front of you, family is almost always that. Now, you said earlier, you're not guaranteed to get married, but you have a good chance. You have a good chance. Especially if, as a young human being, you prioritize that. So you mentioned, you know, how many young men desire to be a father. What I find interesting is that my young man that I have is maybe a little young to get this question. But when my young women get the question, what do you want to be when you grow up? Which I don't like that question for other philosophical reasons. Children are not equipped to answer that question. But we're teaching them to desire motherhood. And it's very interesting how they are shamed by other Christians when they give that answer. They are shamed. Yeah. And they've learned now to hesitate and not answer quickly, even though they want to. And that is so sad to me. It's just so sad to me.
It's also saying that your value in life, what it is that you will find to be important, will be something that will make money for you or some giant corporation that doesn't care about you. That is soul crushing when you actually stop and think about it. When you're 70 years old, do you want to look back on your tax returns? I want to see grandchildren when I'm 70. The tax returns can come and go. They'll rise and they'll fall. It really doesn't matter. Getting value in your life from money rather than God and the people he's given you is just about the worst thing to tell somebody to do, because it will destroy them. And Abraham is proof that it doesn't make you happy. It doesn't bring blessedness. He is absolutely miserable, even with all the stuff that he has. The thing that really concerns him is, you know, as the Psalms have it, seeing children's children.
Psalm 127, 128, if you haven't read them, you should. Okay, I'm going to read the remainder of the text because there's still a good chunk left here, and I'm sure there's other things we can find as valuable as this topic is. It really, really is. So the servant is at the meal, but he's not going to eat. He wants to talk first, so Laban says, go ahead, say what you got to say. Verse 34, so he said, I am Abraham's servant. Yahweh the Lord has greatly blessed my master, and he has become great. He has given him flocks and herds, silver and gold, male servants and female servants, camels and donkeys. This is like your uncle. He's really rich. This is what everybody wants, right? Some guy to come like, hey, by the way, your uncle made it rich. Your long-lost uncle. And Sarah, my master's wife, bore a son to my master when she was old, and to him he has given all that he has. My master made me swear, saying, you shall not take a wife for my son from the daughters of the Canaanites, in whose land I dwell. This is all kind of review at this point too, right? We've heard this. But you shall go to my father's house and to my clan and take a wife for my son. I said to my master, perhaps the woman will not follow me. That's new. But he said to me, the Lord before whom I have walked will send his angel with you and prosper your way. You shall take a wife for my son from my clan and from my father's house. Then you will be free from my oath when you come to my clan. And if they will not give her to you, you will be free from my oath. Verse 42, I came today to the spring and said, O Lord, O Yahweh, the God of my master Abraham, if you are now prospering the way that I go, behold, I am standing by the spring of water. Let the virgin who comes out to draw water, to whom I shall say, please give me a little water from your jar to drink. And you will say to me, drink, and I will draw for your camels also. Let her be the woman whom the Lord has appointed for my master's son. Verse 45, but before I had finished speaking in my heart, behold, Rebecca came out with her water jar on her shoulder. So again, repeating, very Hebraic, by the way, to tell the whole story a second time, with her water jar on her shoulder. And she went down to the spring and drew water. I said to her, please let me drink. She quickly let down her jar from her shoulder and said, drink, and I will give your camels drink also. So I drank, and she gave the camels drink also. Then I asked her, whose daughter are you? She said, the daughter of Bethuel, Nahor's son, whom Milcah bore to him. So I put the ring on her nose and the bracelets on her arm. Then I bowed my head and worshipped the Lord and blessed the Lord, the God of my master Abraham, who has led me by the right way to take the daughter of my master's kinsman for his son. Now then, if you are going to show steadfast love and faithfulness to my master, tell me. And if not, tell me that I may turn to the right hand or to the left. Then Laban and Bethuel answered and said, the thing has come from the Lord. We cannot speak to you bad or good. Behold, Rebekah is before you. Take her and go, and let her be the wife of your master's son, as the Lord has spoken. Isaac's name not mentioned either. Interesting. So what strikes me in this, Pastor Kuntz, is for the ancient world talk, this is super uber direct. Like, he ain't beating around the bush in the conversation at all. Remember a few moments ago when Abraham's buying a grave, right? And they're like, oh, you can have it for free. No, I'll pay the full price. Oh, but what is that between friends? Right? They're in this big barter situation. Here, he's just like, hey, guys, so I want her to come with me to get married. Like, that's super direct. And then they're like, yeah, it's from God. So I think that stands out by itself. I know, Pastor Kuntz, you see other things there. What else do you see?
Yeah, I think the determinate nature of this discussion is all because of its urgency. And I don't think we can stress that enough, that as this man is acting faithfully and Abraham is acting faithfully, trusting that the Lord will provide a wife for his son so that the promise can be continued to another generation. As all of that is happening, there is nervousness. There is concern, right? Being faithful is not the same thing as expelling every bad or contrary emotion from your life. Those things do come and go, but I think you can see it in the directness with which he speaks to them. The thing about the repetition is that you can tell that many Bible stories are meant to be heard rather than to be read, because repetition that may be at least, you know, okay, I've seen this before, or may even be boring to somebody reading it, is entertaining and a good reminder for someone who is only listening, who doesn't have a text in front of him. So the repetition here is because the story is a story. It's meant to be told. It's meant to be heard. As it's heard, the one thing that you're going to notice is just the little details where you called attention to one of them. In verse 39, he said, I said to my master, perhaps the woman will not follow me. The comfort that Abraham gives him is that his angel will be with you and prosper your way. The angel could be the angel of the Lord, the pre-incarnate Christ. The angel could also be an angel, a kind of protector or guardian. It's not really clear. But the purpose here is, again, that angels serve humanity. Humanity does not exist to serve angels. That really can't be said enough today. You don't turn into an angel when you die, because the angels are here to serve you. So the angel's going to prosper him. And then, you know, Abraham says, like, look, if they don't, you know, let her come with you, you've done your job. I think that notion of service is it's about faithfulness rather than outcomes. So
it's interesting. Yeah. I thought about this while I was reading it. Like, yeah. He keeps calling Abraham my master.
Yeah.
Right. And he's not like a slave the way that English now has that word mean slave. So it's very challenging for us to talk about ancient world servanthood because we're so peppered by this radically evil thing that our country did years and years ago. But at the same time, it's not unlike the slavery that is here today when you have a job that your livelihood is tied to, your pension plan, your health care. It's like you can't just up and go. And like you wouldn't walk in to work and like call your boss my master, right? In love. Yeah? And here he is. This is how he views this. Is this just duty? I don't know. And he's committed to him. And you see this from other servants in the scriptures as well. They're committed. They're loyal. And there's something about that is pretty beautiful, really, but I think difficult for us to access because of a number of linguistic issues.
Yeah, it's also because everything – this goes back to the discussion of whether money or family is more worthwhile ultimately. Almost everything in our world is monetized, including our relationships. So a relationship that would have been not only economic but also personal – between Abraham and his servant, where the servant is provided for by Abraham, he lives with him, not necessarily like in the same room, but among his things in his tent, so that relationship is not only economic, it's also personal, and it's lifelong. Those things are monetized and depersonalized, right? So when someone says, I work for Siemens, there's no Mr. Siemens that person like knows or sends a Christmas card to. That person works for, however many shareholders, ultimately, and for a boss within a division in a branch office or whatever. It's all depersonalized and it is, monetized, right? You are worth so much money. If you start to cost more than that, you may lose your job. It's nothing personal, right? They're structuring their world very differently. It's not depersonalized such that my master is a man I know. I know what his face looks like. I know what his voice sounds like. I know what he likes to eat. He did this and that for me. We go hunting. Abraham takes, when he is Abram, he takes these men to war to regain his family earlier on in Genesis. So everything is very personal here.
I love it, and part of me as a man, I think I long for it, but I don't know what that looks like in reality. The closest we come to this, that I can understand it, is leadership theory, which still is hyper-monetized, business-oriented, right? Yeah. But the companies that do the most impactful things in the world are those that have men whom people follow and who they are committed to those men.
Right.
You go back 50, 60 years, the presidents and or generals who are still known today, same kind of thing. But there's not like an avenue for that in your neighborhood, at least not really. We're so segmented ourselves. We've only got about 3 minutes left here, Pastor Kutz, so we don't have to chase that one. We can go wherever you want. I want to make sure you get what you want to say out and then bring us the most important stuff here at the end.
Yeah, the permission given at the very end with where Laban and Bethuel, and this is her father, finally appears in verse 50. Bethuel, the son of Milcah, is finally there. Now, he has been absent so far. He's not dead. It seemed like he was. He finally shows up, but his son, Laban, is named first. So it's a little hard to know exactly why that is. Is Laban come of age, so to speak, and he's making decisions with his father. While these families are patriarchally structured, they are not structured so as simply to maintain the sole and total authority of the father of the family over everything alone. They're different from the Romans that way, right? Bethuel is not allowed to. A Roman father could, kill anybody in the family for shaming the family. Here they are making decisions together about marriages. So I want to be clear about that because biblical patriarchy is not exactly the same thing, certainly as what you've been told patriarchy is, and it's not even the same thing as what the surrounding cultures practiced as patriarchy. So they say the thing has come from the Lord. We cannot speak to you bad or good. Like this is the way it's going, because what he has laid out is the sequence of events and how everything has lined up. And they say, okay, great, let's go. And they describe that sequence of things as the Lord has spoken. And I think that reference to God's voice is important, not only in their recognition of these events as in accord with God's will, but also as recognition of this marriage as part of God's fulfillment of his word. This is part of what springs up when his word goes forth, right, according to Isaiah 55, is that what he wants to happen, what he has promised will happen, surely does.
So he's laid the groundwork for that, so that this promise to come to pass in Jesus Christ will press forward. You mentioned the patriarchs several times, Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, not Joseph so much, although he often is in the story. They are who they are because they are the beginning of the lineage that leads us to the flesh of Jesus Christ. Got 30 seconds more if you want to say one more thing.
Yeah, that's right. Their family lineage, the land, all of it does not matter in and of itself. It matters because Christ will inherit it all, and he will be the finally and fully and perfectly monogamous bridegroom to his bride, the church. And they leave a beautiful heritage for us of faith and God's fulfillment of his promises down through the ages. So Christ is what we're looking forward to in all of this, with the marriage and the land, and all of it is leading to Christ, who is the one who will inherit it all.
And even the choosing of a spouse who will be faithful to you forever, that also is mysteriously about Christ and his church. Pastor Adam Kuntz is pastor of Mount Calvary Lutheran Church in Lititz, Pennsylvania, helping us out with Genesis chapter 24, verses 15 through 51, a yeoman's task this morning here on Sharper Iron, reminding us that in all these things, it ultimately is about Christ for you, dead, raised, ascended, and returning. I'm your host, Pastor Jonathan Fisk, and I look forward to waking up with you at that dawn.